Peter Williams is our guest teacher today. He's been a friend for a number of years. Peter went when he was growing up. His dad was, I found, an army officer in the British Army who was converted at a Billy Graham crusade in the 1950s. And so Peter was saying to me at breakfast, in a way, the reason he's here this morning is Billy Graham, because his father was converted and then Peter became a Christian. Peter went to Cambridge University, which is, according to many people, the most highly ranked university in England. And instead of just majoring in one thing, Peter decided to major in two things. And instead of just taking easy things, he decided to major, on the one hand, in Hebrew and Aramaic. And then just for something else to do, he majored in classics, which is Greek and Latin. And graduated with highest honors in the university in both subjects. So the university asked him to stay on. Why don't you stay here and teach Hebrew for a while? So he did teach Hebrew and Syriac, I believe. And then because he had expertise in New Testament, it's really unusual, but the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, a historic, prestigious university, said, come and teach New Testament. And he was there at a comfortable position on a track to be there for life, really, and have prestige in the university system in England. But he got a call from Tyndall House Research Library, which is right next to Cambridge University, bumps right up next to it, but it's not officially under the university. It's a sound evangelical research library where I actually worked and did my PhD. And would Peter come and be the warden there? I know warden in the United States we think is someone who runs a prison, but warden in England means like the executive director. So Peter is in charge of that, and that means he has 40 people working there at any time. We're academics from around the world working on doctorates in Old Testament, New Testament, and he gives guidance to them and kind of coaches and encourages. And how do you do this? And how can you be faithful to the Word of God and yet do this research and go through your program and be and stay faithful? And so it's a community of evangelical scholars. It's, I think, unique in the world. And God has given him a stewardship with that.
Thanks very much, Wayne. It's absolutely great to be here. Thank you for your welcome. I was talking to my wife yesterday, and I also spoke to my parents, and I said, can you just imagine perfect weather? This is what we have. So I'm told it gets rather hot at other times, but I'm really enjoying my first time here. So turn with me in your Bibles to Joshua chapter 2, and we're going to read it through. What I think I'll do is I'll read the first 14 verses just to give you the British English experience, and then we can read through together on the handouts for the last bit, so you don't get fed up with my voice. So here we are, Joshua chapter 2. And Joshua, the son of Nun, sent two men secretly from Shittim as spies, saying, go view the land, especially Jericho. And they went and came into the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab and lodged there. And it was told to the king of Jericho, behold, men of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land. Then the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. And she said, true, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And when the gate was about to be closed at dark, the men went out. I don't know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them. But she had brought them up to the roof and hid them with stalks of flax that she had laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued after them on the way of the Jordan as far as the fords. And the gate was shut as soon as the pursuers had gone. Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to them, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you devoted to destruction. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that, as I've dealt kindly with you, you also will deal kindly with my father's house, and give me a sure sign that you will save alive my father and my mother, my brothers, sisters, and all that belong to them, and deliver our lives from death. And the men said to her, our life for yours, even to death. If you do not tell this business of ours, then when the Lord gives us the land, we will deal kindly and faithfully with you. Now let's try all together. If it doesn't work, we can stop, but we can at least try from verse 15. If you've got a handout, how many people don't have the handout with the verse? Okay, I don't know if there are any spares around. If they can get passed to people, that would be absolutely great, so everyone can have a copy. Okay, together. Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was built into the city wall, so that she lived in the wall. And she said to them, go into the hills, or the pursuers will encounter you, and hide there 3 days until the pursuers have returned. Then afterward, you may go to your way. The men said to her, we will be guiltless with respect to this oath of yours that you have made us swear. Behold, when we come into the land, you shall tie this scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down, and you shall gather into your house your father and mother, your brothers, and all your father's household. Then if anyone goes out of the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head, and we shall be guiltless. But if a hand is laid on anyone who is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head. But if you tell this business of ours, then we will be guiltless with respect to your oath that you have made us swear. And she said, according to your words, so be it. Then she sent them away, and they departed. And she tied the scarlet cord in the window. They departed and went into the hills and remained there 3 days until the pursuers returned. And the pursuers searched all along the way and found nothing. Then the two men returned. They came down from the hills and passed over and came to Joshua the son of Nun, and they told him all that had happened to them. And they said to Joshua, truly the Lord has given all the land into our hands, and also all the inhabitants of the land melt away because of us. Well, Wayne said I was going to teach the class, but really, you're going to have to do all the work. So I hope you don't mind if we have questions. There are going to be some microphones. And so if you can just wait for the microphone, and that will make sure that everyone can hear the interaction. So the first question is, when we're looking at a passage, is what happens before this? So what's the context of this leading up to this? Anyone want to start us off? Don't be shy, because otherwise shyness will take up time. It's like the spam. We need to take away the shyness. Just raise a hand and a microphone will come. And okay.
40 years of slavery.
Okay, so they've had 40 years wandering in the desert. They've had the slavery in Egypt, yeah? And what is about to happen? Okay, they're going into the promised land. How are they going to get into the promised land? What's going to happen? They're going to cross the Jordan, right? And then what are they going to do in the promised land? Conquer it. What's that going to involve? What's that going to mean for the people currently in the promised land? Who are they? Who are the people currently in the promised land? The Canaanites. And so what have they been told by God to do to the Canaanites? Kill them. Why? Uh-huh. Because the Canaanites are sinful. In fact, it says in Genesis chapter 15, verse 16, God says he will not send his people in to the promised land until the people there have become so bad. He says the iniquity of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. That the Amorites were some of the Canaanites, the people grouping in the land. Now, has anyone heard a moral objection to the Bible relating to that? In fact, it's something you're hearing more and more nowadays. It's the moral objection to the Old Testament based on, well, if God could tell people then to kill people, what difference is that from suicide bombers and so on? You can hear the attack, and it's coming particularly since 9/11, by a group that sometimes people call the New Atheists. The New Atheists, people like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, who wrote the Letter to a Christian Nation, Christopher Hitchens and so on, are making this objection and saying the Bible is really immoral because of what is commanded there. Now, what they in fact do in order to do that is ignore all sorts of other things that go on in the Bible. They ignore the fact that the Canaanites were sacrificing their own children in large numbers. They ignore the sin that was involved there, and so on. Now, I'm not going to get into an answer to that objection, except for the fact that in Joshua chapter 2, we're right on the threshold of that, and suddenly we've got this narrative. What happens in this narrative? Just someone gives an outline. Is anyone destroyed? So what goes on? What's it a story of? A story of spies, yeah? And a sweet prostitute. It's a story of rescue, isn't it? That right on the threshold of this thing that everyone sees, the destruction of the nations, it's a story of God's special provision and care for an individual from those nations. And I think it's quite important for us to realize that this is right at the beginning of Joshua, before any of the bloodshed we're going to see, that suddenly we see, in a sense, a focus on God's heart. Because often what people do with the Bible is they say, well, how many chapters do we have on this? How many chapters do we have on that? And because they see that a lot of the Bible is about judgment, they think, well, that's what it's all about. When in fact, when we read the Bible, we need to start with what happens at the beginning, what are God's intentions, God's plans, and you see God makes things perfect and without suffering and so on. And it doesn't matter how many chapters you read in terms of the space they take up, they are to be understood in that framework. And so what we've got to do, really, as we read this passage, is capture God's heart as we see this. Okay, so let's just begin with going through some of the details. So chapter 2, verse 1. Joshua, the son of Nun, sent two men secretly from Shittim as spies. Let's start with the spies. Where else do we have spies in the Old Testament? Anywhere else? 40 years ago. Okay, so Numbers chapter 13. How many spies were sent out? Three? Any advance on three? 12. Yeah, okay, that's 12. And what do the spies do? Don't worry, Paddy. That was a quarter of them you got.
They're afraid.
Okay, how many of them were afraid? How many of them? 10. So how many gave a good report?
Two.
Okay, so how many spies do we have this time?
Two.
Okay, so it seems to work, doesn't it? I mean, it's two good spies last time and two this time. In fact, you get some more spies in Joshua 7 verse 2 as well. Joshua sends out spies. Are we told that God sent him to told him to send out these spies? No, but there's no reason to think it was a bad thing. He did it again in chapter 7. He sends them secretly. So who knows about these spies? God knows about the spies. The spies knows about the spies. And Joshua knows about the spies. But this time, do the Israelites know about the spies? I mean, obviously, spies go out secretly for the people of Jericho, but why would it say secretly if it didn't also mean that the Israelites don't know about the spies? Now, why might it be important that the Israelites don't know about the spies? Well, what happened last time there were spies? 40 years ago, the spies had come back and said, oh, it's so scary in there, you don't want to go. And that had made, it brought about a situation of rebellion. This time, Joshua doesn't allow that, and so he knows what's going on. And he says, go view the land, especially Jericho. And they went and came into a house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab and lodged there. Well, we're glad there were two of them when they went to that house. Anyway, now, my question is, why did they go to Rahab's house? Anyone, why did they go to Rahab's house? I mean, why not someone else's house? Why Rahab's house? Any practical reasons why they went to Rahab's house? Strangers are welcome, yeah, and that sort of house. So that's a very good reason, and, you know, some sort of back alley on the wall, apparently, might be easier to creep in. They seem to have got in the dusk, I would say. Okay, ask the question again. Why did they go to Rahab's house? Let's have a more theological reason. Why did they go to Rahab's house? God sent them. So did they know about Rahab? So what you see incredibly here is that by God's divine plan, they have gone to the one house of the one person in Jericho who fears God. So isn't that an incredible thing that here we see divine planning and human action going together beautifully. And that's happening in our lives right now, that we are working things out and we think we're making decisions and they think that they're going to a house that is easier to get into because, after all, a house where they welcome strangers more regularly. So that's maybe some of their reasoning, and it's easier to get to. But God, at the same time, has his plan. And what we're going to see is the remarkable nature of this. So, was it risky for the spies? Yeah. They get, and then in verse 2, things seem to go wrong. In verse 2, it was told the king of Jericho that, behold, men have come here tonight to search out the land. Now, it's going to be darker a bit later, so I think this is tonight, sort of dusk time. The gates are still open. The report is out, their lives are in danger. And the king of Jericho sent to Rahab. Fortunately, she had got wind of this. And it does seem that the people of Jericho were bungling this a little bit. Because after all, if they had actually followed the men, then this wouldn't they wouldn't have been able to get away. So let's put it this way. It seems that they're being held back from competence in this narrative. And that's significant, because often we can plan our best and it won't work unless God blesses and succeeds, makes the plan succeed. And so that's what we see going on here. The king of Jericho sent to Rahab saying, bring out the men who've come to you, who entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. Now, she says, true, the men came to me. She's got a bit of nerve, hasn't she? So she really takes control of the situation. I just think she's a phenomenal woman. And she says, true. She affirms it. The men came to me, but I don't know where they were from. And when the gate was about to close at dark, the men went out. Pursue them. Go on. Go really quickly. Oh, I really hope you get them, she says, and for you will overtake them. So she sends them off. And, well, they believe her. I mean, that's already a remarkable thing. Now, did she tell the truth? No. Okay, she told a lie. Is it a good thing to lie? Are there sometimes circumstances in which, in order to protect someone, we need to lie? Now, this is a key verse in the Bible that some people use to justify the view that sometimes you can have a good lie in a righteous cause. So, I've got some, Patty's shaking her head. Why is that wrong?
Because my teacher taught me that it is wrong.
Okay, so your teacher taught...
that God is sovereign and you need to always follow the Lord.
That's a great answer. Anyone else want to chip in here? Anyone want to defend what she did? So her teacher had always, her teacher taught her that it was wrong, and also that God's sovereign and we need to trust him. Sometimes people say there are circumstances in which you need to lie. I love the story about the person who was taking Bibles into Eastern Europe when it was communist and it wasn't allowed, and he had a whole van full of Bibles, and person at the border said, have you got any Bibles in there? And he said, yeah, the whole van's full of them. And of course the person said, oh, come on. You know, he thought he was joking. So, you know, he told the truth and he got through. So you never know. You know, God's sovereign. But what we see is she commended for, what's she commended for in the Bible? Her faith. Okay, let's have a look at some verses. Could someone get a microphone and be prepared to read some verses? So if we could have Hebrews 11:31, someone with a microphone and a Bible, if you can turn up that, which is a commendation for her, and then someone on the other side, if you can do James 2:25, which is another commendation of her. So if we can have just a volunteer, don't be backward in coming forward. So have we got anyone here? Well, I mean, if you're not going to do the work, then I'll have to. Okay.
By faith, Rahab the prostitute did not perish with those who were disobedient, because she had given a friendly welcome to the spies.
Okay, so by faith, she is an example of faith. What is she commended for? Is she commended for lying or for something else? What's she commended for? Giving a friendly welcome to the spies. Okay, James chapter 2, verse 25. Has anyone got it?
And in the same way, it was not also Rahab the prostitute justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way. For as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so also faith apart from works is dead.
So there you see, she's justified by works. That is shown to be just right with God by what she did. And what was what she did? She received the spies and sent them out by another way. In other words, sent them to the mountains where they could be safe. So what's the thing, the shouting voice that you don't hear there is there's another group she sent. She sent on another way. Yeah? She sent the king's men on another way. And that's not what justified her. So it's quite interesting that when you read it, the Bible, she's not commended for lying. Could someone read Joshua 6, verse 25, please? This is Joshua 6, verse 25 is Joshua's own take on the situation and why Rahab is spared. Joshua 6, 25.
But Rahab the prostitute and her father's household and all who belonged to her, Joshua saved alive. And she has lived in Israel to this day because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho.
Because she hid the messengers. That's again what she's commended for. So it's not commended for lying. Now, of course, God looks at her heart and God sees the action that she did in protecting the spies and sees that far outweighing the precise method she used, which was lying. Now, was there any risk to her? Huge. Yeah. So that's another key thing here, that we see the personal risk that she is undertaking on behalf of these people that she has only just met. And so we're going to have to think more and more about why she is doing this. So anyway, what she had done is, verse 6, she had brought them up onto the roof and hidden them under stalks of flax. By the way, that's just a lovely detail there, an eyewitness detail, because it fits exactly with the time of the narrative, because we know the time of year that this took place. And we know that this is the time of year when they've just had the flax harvest. And so, of course, you lay them out on the roof. So there are little details like that that are verifying, showing you this is true, this is not just made up. And you lay them flat on the roof, and here are these guys flat underneath it. It doesn't even seem that the king's men searched the house. So the king's men, verse 7, go and they pursue them as far as the fords of Jericho, and then the gate was shut as soon as the men were out. What does it mean that the gate shut? Any issues arising from that? Yeah? What are the issues? Anyone? Shout out? They can't get back out. So now the men are stuck in Jericho. And there's a hunt going on. Well, they would have reason to be scared. But before the men lay down, before they'd gone down to sleep, that is, in verse 8, she came to them on the roof, and this is what she said. I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came up out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you devoted to destruction. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. Now I've got a question. How did she know all that? Has anyone got any sense? How did she know, come to that recognition? She is a prostitute, so she sort of came across travelers, let's say. Okay. That's, anyone else?
God told her.
God told her. I mean, I think that's absolutely key, that she's in this city surrounded by these people who have completely different thoughts, and her heart has been turned. So where's her allegiance? What's her nationality? She's not a person of Jericho at this point. She's a person who looks to God for her identity. And I think this is just phenomenal. I know. She's not saying perhaps. She really has become completely convinced, not just that they have a God who can do things, but that the Lord has given them this land. Now think about what that means, because she should have next to her two petrified spies, who know that there's a chase on, and they know that they're in trouble. But she looks around at that situation that she's in, the city that she's grown up in, and she sees that it belongs to the people of God. I mean, that is, you remember that verse at the beginning of Hebrews 11 where it says, but faith being the evidence of things not seen, that the way that you can have confidence in something you can't actually see around you. Now, how can that be a lesson to us nowadays? What she sees, I mean, she's an example of faith, isn't she? Because she can see things as they really are, not as they seem to be on the basis of the numbers of people around her. So what sort of practical implications could that have for us nowadays? If we take her as an example.
We have the same report that she had,
uh-huh.
We just have it more fully.
Uh-huh.
In other words, we not only have what she had, we have her story, we have everything else in Scripture. So it's just the report of the Lord. The victories have reached us as surely as they reached her.
Yeah, so in that sense, if she reached the conclusions that she did on the basis of the amount of information she had, that makes everyone else inexcusable. Just in terms of, we have had so much more evidence of God's working and so much more greater record of it and so on. Okay, so if you look at the world nowadays, who does it look like it belongs to? Well, we know that God's in charge, but often you can look at the world and you say, well, who is in charge? You can look at it and you can say, it doesn't look like it belongs to God. It doesn't look like one day the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. It doesn't look like that. And so faith is having the same as Rahab had in that situation in Jericho, and being able to see what situation things will be in the future. So I think that's an incredible challenge to us, because I think each one of us is in situations where the natural thing is not to see. And she saw. She says, I know that the Lord has given you this land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us. As a great study you could do in fear. Because four times in the first chapter, Joshua is told, or three times he's told not to fear and to be courageous, and then he tells other people not to fear and be courageous, and then you could go back a few chapters in Deuteronomy and you've got Moses saying the same. This is so key. Who do you fear? Because who ought she to have been fearing, humanly speaking, at that point? She ought to have been fearing the people who are on the chase, the king's men, humanly speaking. But actually, she is fearing God. And that's just an incredible thing, isn't it? That she looks around her and she doesn't see what looks like the imposing threat. She sees rather the question of God coming in with his people. And I think so easily we could fear various things. We can fear situations internationally, nationally, with politics, with finance, whatever it is. And we can have our fears driven by those and not actually think the person we ought to fear is God. So we shouldn't be fearing what our neighbor will think of us if we say something, or fear what people will think of us at work or whatever. We should be fearing God. But the fear of you has fallen upon us, and all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. Because they had all heard, not just her, but the others had heard as well, what God had done. But the difference is, when she heard what God had done, she put her loyalty in God, and the others didn't. And then she lists what had done, and then she comes to the conclusion, verse 11. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth belief. Now, if he's God everywhere, then there isn't room for anyone else. So I think this is just an incredible conclusion that she had come to. That she realized that he was the one who owned everything. And then she asked, therefore, that they swear to her, verse 12, by God. She wants, just as she has shown kindness, that they show kindness to her. And I think one of the things I love about this is she's a good negotiator as well. I mean, she doesn't just manage to send off, you know, the king's men on a wild goose chase. She also manages to negotiate for her mom, her dad, her brothers and sisters, all of their belongings, family, all to be all right. Although she's presumably a single lady, she also is concerned for them, and that is granted. So it's interesting, actually, that clearly, before God, these spies had it in their discretion to remit the command to destroy everyone, to some extent. Does that make sense? You also see this in the beginning of a book of Judges, again, when there is someone, I think it's Judges 1:25, where someone is let off. So the destruction of the Canaanites, firstly, is not on the basis of their race, it's on the basis of their wickedness. That's a very important thing when we read through the Old Testament. And secondly, there are various counterexamples, like the Gibeonites, like Rahab and her extended family, who were not destroyed. One further point, when people say it's all about racism and it's genocide, when you read through the Old Testament, when Israel becomes as bad as the Canaanites were, they suffer the same. So in fact, it is a question of justice, not what people might call genocide nowadays. We had a question just over there, is that right? Sir?
Killing is not always murder. Case in point, Sir Kelly, cutting heads off of people, such as Daniel Pearl. We dropped 2 500-pound bombs on him for his rudeness. That was self-defense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, with an Irish name like mine, the stereotype, I'd either be a priest, a fireman, or a cop. Cops and firemen, both dangerous jobs. Firemen get all the glory, but cops are paid assassins when necessary. I wouldn't want to be a cop. I'd feel lousy if I had to kill somebody, but either him or me.
Sure. Now, I mean, obviously, there is certain killing which is legitimated. I mean, ultimately, God has the right over everyone's life. What I'm just aware is that as we talk about that, there are certain people in society, a lot of them, who are now making a regular association between religion and violence. You hear it in the media? You've heard it on the media? Religion and violence. Now, you're a Christian. You're religious. That associates you with violence. That's the cunning move that's going on. It's a lie. Yeah? But, I mean, when you look at the devil's lie back in Genesis chapter 3, verse 5, you see that there is something corresponding to the truth in every bit of it. You know? I mean, should we just do that? I know we're not planning to look at Genesis 3, but we might as well look at Genesis 3, verse 5, just so you know how lies work. This is what he says. Genesis 3, verse 4, the serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die." Well, she didn't die straight away. So that was true, to some extent. "For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." Well, you look just a little bit later, and what happens is, verse 7, the eyes of both were opened. So that was true as well. And then we see at the end of the passage, God says, 3 verse 22, "Behold, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil." So every single bit that he said had some correspondence in the truth, and yet it was a lie. So that's the way the devil works. And so the way that society is working nowadays is a lie about what's going on here. But it's a lie which has got enough grains of truth put into it that it seems plausible. And so we've got to be ready to know how to respond to that. When people say, religion causes violence, you're religious, that actually means that you're like those people who harbor terrorists and so on. We need to be ready to know how to respond and wise to do so. So what we see in verse 14 is they swear on their own life that she will be safe. And then she lets them down by a rope. Their lives are hanging by a thread, we might say, through a window. Wasn't it amazing the way that her house was on a wall? And interesting, archaeologically, it's been found with Jericho, or what I understand to be Jericho of the time, that there were two sort of walls. There are two words for wall in the Hebrew here, and that there were houses built upon the wall. So that's just shows how things were. And she also has the wisdom to send them on a new route to make sure that they go to the mountains out of the way of being searched for, and to hide for 3 days, and that way they would get away. So she is really shrewd. Now they then lay on her one more thing three more things that she has to do. Firstly, she has to tie the scarlet thread in the window. Secondly, she has to gather her whole family into the house. And thirdly, she's got to make sure she doesn't tell anyone about it. Now, I want to ask the question, what do the spies know about how God is going to conquer Jericho? Well, then let's start with another question. How does God conquer Jericho? Yeah, just briefly. The walls fall down. You know, they go around the walls 6 days, seventh day, they go around seven times, so they go around 13 times, and then the walls fall down. Does every bit of the wall fall down? No, is there a bit of the wall that doesn't fall down? Rahab's house. I mean, it's amazing God's sovereignty, just that you see in all of this, that they're making their plans, and yet God is completely sovereign in it. Now, do the spies know at this stage what is going to happen? Do they know that the walls are going to fall? Has God told them that? No. Joshua doesn't know that. Joshua just knows that he has to go around the city. And he just gets told another time, go around again and again and again. He doesn't know what he's got to do, except last time you've got to shout. So he does that, not knowing what God's going to do, and God brings the walls down. So they were probably thinking it's going to be street-to-street fighting, and they need to get all of the family together into one house in order to keep them safe, and they'll go in and they'll rescue and they'll make sure she's all right. What they don't realize is that their plan, so to speak, gets taken up in God's plan. Of course, God had it planned out all along, but it seems that their plan gets taken up in God's plan, and so that their idea of a safe house, well, it really is kept safe. Have there been any more safe houses previously in the Old Testament when you've been reading through? Safe houses, gather everyone into the house and then they'll be safe, yeah?
The ark.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, any more? The Passover. So in those two times, you've got symbols of God saying, if you are not in this place, then you will not be kept safe. And that's absolutely key, the way God cares for his people. Tell me about the Passover. What would a Passover house look like? Blood on the doorpost, yeah. What color's blood?
Red.
What color's this cord? Red, yeah. I mean, is it coincidence? So what's interesting in those cases, and obviously the red in the case of the Passover speaks of the Passover lamb, and we know from 1 Corinthians Christ is described as our Passover lamb, the offering. And I don't want to draw too much into a red cord, but I would see a hint here of the way of salvation. Now, some people can say that's exaggerated typology, but I would see that at least. But the clear thing is that they have to be, the whole family has to be in this place in order to be kept safe. And of course, God keeps them safe in a remarkable way. And she also has to make sure she doesn't tell anyone. There's absolute secrecy about this. So then what happens is they depart, verse 22, and they go to the hills. They remain there for 3 days. The pursuers returned. They searched everywhere and found nothing. So it's not just that they're making their plans. God is prospering their plans throughout. Because there are so many points at which things could have gone wrong. If you just think of them, I mean, they could have been caught as they went in the gate. They could have been caught by getting followed in the house. They could have got followed to the house and then the house searched. They could have been found out leaving, and yet they were not. Amazingly, at every point, God prospers what they do. The two men returned, and they came down from the hills, passed over there, and said to Joshua, son of Nun, and this is their conclusion. Ready for it? Verse 24. Truly, the Lord has given the land into our hands, and also the inhabitants of the land melt away because of it. Now, is that a surprising conclusion? Before this chapter, before the spies had gone out, did they know whether or not the Lord had delivered it into their hands? Yeah. How did they know that? God had said it. That's right. So we go back to Deuteronomy chapter 31. So the immediate context, the book before, because of course the books just continue, part of the same narrative. But you could find it many times, Joshua chapter, Deuteronomy 31. So Moses continued to speak all these words to Israel. And he said, I am 120 years old today. I'm no longer able to go out and come in. The Lord has said to me, you shall go over this Jordan, and the Lord your God will go over you. He will destroy these nations before you, and so you shall dispossess them. Joshua will go over at your head as the Lord has spoken. And he says, verse 6, be strong and courageous. Do not fear or be in dread of them, for it is the Lord your God who goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. And then again, verse 8, it's the Lord who goes before you. He will be with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. Do not fear or be dismayed. So there's this emphasis all the way in the surrounding chapters on God's with you. Don't be afraid. So they know already. So their conclusion at the end doesn't add any new information at that level. It does tell them that the people of the land will fear, are afraid, but they'd also been told that before. So in fact, their conclusion wasn't telling you much new. Now, what's so interesting to me is Rahab had got there first. I mean, here are the Israelites who've been told by God what God's going to do, and after their great... what a risk to get that little information, that little new information. They've just risked their lives, and they come back knowing that, well, what God said is true. But they knew that already. Couldn't they have saved themselves all that effort? So why did it all happen? Well, God had a plan. God wanted to rescue this woman. And so they've gone into a land at, you know, huge risk for themselves to find absolutely no new information, but they've rescued a woman. And I think that's just an incredible thing. When I read this chapter, I think about God's heart, God's concern for the individual. That God sees past all of the... rest of the situation to this one woman that he wants to save and who has set her heart to seek him. And I think if we set our hearts to seek God, then God's extravagant in the way that he will devise ways of blessing that. I mean, the extravagance of risking people's lives, holding up the campaign for a few days while they go in, just for this individual. I love it. I mean, I suppose God has infinite resources and we don't, and that sometimes makes us think that we can't be so extravagant. You think about time, you know, we've got limited time, we can't just be extravagant with our time. Well, God's just extravagant because he has these infinite resources, and we need to wisely imitate that at the same time as we bear in mind our resources are finite. But Rahab had got there already. Let's just think then, as we conclude, I'm going to bring things to an end. I want to think firstly about the spies. Are there any lessons from the spies for us? Let's think practically now. We're not going to be going in great detail through the text at this point. I just want to think, how can we apply this to us? And we're going to look at the spies, then Rahab and God. So, any lessons from the spies? Any examples to follow? Obedience. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, obedience, yeah?
Don't fear.
Don't fear. So, I mean, there was a real risk. I mean, you think of that as the city gate. You've got to go through it. And you know, you don't know anyone in that town at all. I mean, people think, you know, they get scared about going into a strange church or something. But here, you know, you're talking about going into enemy territory. You know, you don't know how to speak like they speak. You don't know what the layout of the buildings is just beyond that gate, that city gate, as you go in. But they go in obedience. And what is amazing about that is just they get away. I mean, that, you know, you would have thought it was sure death. I mean, it's one thing, those 12 spies who'd went out 40 years before, because they were like spying out the land and they were keeping at a very good distance from the locals. You know, they were saying, oh, yeah, well, we got some grapes here and so on. That's fine, looking at the vines. But, you know, actually going near the people, no, they didn't want to do that. But here, these spies are brave and they're obedient to what Joshua, under God, has sent them to do, even though it might look quite foolhardy. So, I mean, that's certainly an example for us. Anything more about the spies? Ways they challenge us? Yeah. Yeah. So, thanks, Joyce. The faith that they show, because they're, again, committed to God. Yeah. Anyone else?
And almost, I mean, they knew this was very serious, the oath mm-hmm. and the swearing they were going into. And they made provisions for, you know, if one goes out, their blood's on their head and it's not on ours.
Yeah, so it's not a blank check. They just sort of sign away and say, well, whatever, we'll rescue you in any situation. They're really careful about the commitment that they are making. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, sir. Yeah.
Go through the doors that God opens.
Go through the doors that God opens. That's a great one, yeah.
Evangelistic,
yeah. Do you want to unpack that at all?
Well, saved his whole family.
Yeah, yeah. So she saved her family. Let's move on to Rahab. Oh, sorry, we've got one more thought on the spies just there at the back, madam. Yeah, I mean, she's really very clued up, and she's saying things that, I mean, neither the spies nor her knew the symbols of divine truth and the whole of the redemptive plan that they were entering in as they made these. I think that's a great thing. Let's go on to Rahab. Examples from Rahab. Yeah, so it's a vision of a changed situation. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Right. So, I mean, just the story of being used in weakness. I mean, like, of all of the people that God would care for, here we got a prostitute. I mean, another example of that, I think, would be the case of Samson. I mean, Samson is someone who is a man of faith used by God, and he's a Nazarite. Well, what are the Nazarites not supposed to do? They're not supposed to touch dead bodies. Yeah? It's a big thing. So what's the first thing? He goes along, oh, here's a lion with some honey inside. Oh, and here's a fresh jawbone of an ass. And so on, and just everything he does, he's not supposed to take wine, so he goes to all these feasts. I mean, you think, how wrong can someone go and still be used by God? Well, what I would say is, in God's sovereignty, God can use people even when they're doing things that are wrong. That is never, ever an excuse for us to do anything wrong. So God's standard is perfection. One of the things I read in a commentary just on this passage, same relation to Rahab's lie, is those who sought to use that as a justification to lie themselves had forgotten how precious truth was to God. Yeah? God really loves truth. God really loves holiness and obedience. The fact that God's so sovereign that he can use other situations for his glory is a different matter. But yeah, God can use sinners. God can use us. Anyone else? Thoughts on Rahab? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. So God protects. That's wonderful. Okay, let's now, that's a great move on to God. Let's now think about what do we learn about God from this story. Yeah.
I like to think that he whispered to her.
You like to think that he whispered to her, right? Yeah, I mean, as in, these people are doing things that are, you know, they really do, the bit in Ephesians 2 where it talks about good works prepared beforehand for us to walk in them. It's Ephesians 2. I'm getting sorry. Thank you. Yeah. God's preparing steps beforehand for us. Yeah. Anyone else? Thoughts on God? What God's doing here? Mm-hmm.
And his plans will ultimately be accomplished.
Yeah, so God is bringing about history, and nothing is turning that back. Yeah. Okay, and we got one at the back, yeah?
I was going to say in 1 Samuel 14, starting in verse 6, there's a corollary to this where Jonathan's talking to his armor bearer.
Yeah.
And he says, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. Come, you have to take the initiative. Perhaps this is not a surety, but if it does happen, it's the Lord.
Yeah, that's a great passage. Now, what's interesting in 1 Samuel is you've got 1 Samuel 13 and 1 Samuel 14. 1 Samuel 13, Saul makes a sacrifice too early because he's afraid that he's losing all his people. And he thinks if he loses all the people, well, then he can't do anything. And the very next chapter teaches that here's Jonathan who starts with nobody and there's victory. So you in fact see, you know, God expects you to follow him, even if you are on your own, or just you and your armor bearer. Pammy.
I love how God, through his grace, was so dear to allow Rahab to be in the lineage of Jesus. And it's such a testament to all of us that no matter where we have been in our lives, that when we turn to Christ and we truly repent, he can do great things, not only through us, but then through our lineage, as she was Boaz's mother. She had to be a good woman to raise such a fine son.
It's an incredible thing. The name of Rahab's husband in Matthew 1 verse 5 is Salmon. Now, Salmon was the son of Nachshon that you know about from Numbers chapter 1, verse 7, who was a leader of the tribe of Judah. And it's often leaders who get sent as spies. And I have my suspicion, but it isn't explicit in the Bible, that one of the spies was the person who, Salmon, who got rather impressed by this woman, let's say. and with good reason. What's so amazing in Matthew chapter 4, you've got the line of Jesus, and you've got four women in it. And each one of them, the wife of Uriah the Hittite, Bathsheba, Ruth, Rahab, and Tamar were all foreigners or associated with foreigners, and God brought them in. Yeah. And here we have a Canaanite, and God brought them into the line. And that's just God's way of bringing those who are excluded, that everyone would have given up on and thought was no hopers. God brings them into his people and into his purposes. And that's what God's doing all the time. I think that's probably about time to close. But thanks very much for all your interaction.